true, because he can, because he can. Alcatraz, 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 Alcatraz. Few have seen your beauty like the Indian has. Few have seen your beauty like the Indian has.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is now 9 o'clock. Up at 9, it's Making Contact, where we hear about the movement through the lens of period activism. At 9:30, it's WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service. But first, this from KBOO.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934. And certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The events committee meets the third Monday of every month at 5 o'clock p.m.
I've never been one to like take a handout. I still have too much pride to stand on an intersection or a corner or a driveway with a sign and ask somebody to help me.
Meet Amy, a homeless person in Corvallis, Oregon. To hear more about her life and what it's like to be homeless, come on over to Local Folks Podcast, Helping the Homeless, for episode 2. You can find Local Folks at kboo.fm. Go to audio, podcasts, and click on Local Folks.
Aspects of women's health and social justice that are often overlooked. From period stigma to the unfair tax on feminine hygiene products and the fight to regulate and disclose ingredients in tampons and maxi pads.
Dearth of good research on vaginal exposures was shocking when I started looking into it. We've got a lot of studies on how chemicals are absorbed through your skin. We've got some studies on how you absorb chemicals into your body when you inhale them. But nobody's looking at the vaginal route, which is really a different story. This is an area of the body covered with mucous membranes. It's very, very permeable. Different chemicals can come in at different levels. Particularly, the chemicals that have been researched are ones that have kind of hormonal properties, things like hormonal contraceptives. And these chemicals will go directly to your uterus. I mean, that's what they found, that the levels kind of systemically in your blood will be very low. They'll be very high in the uterus. So it's really affecting the reproductive system, particularly when chemicals are exposed through this vaginal route.
Tampons, pads, menstrual cups, all used to collect a menstruator's vaginal blood flow while on their period. Wait, did that just repulse you? Well, if it did, get over it. Women bleed on average about 40 to 60 days out of the year. The menstrual cycle is part of what makes pregnancy and life possible in the first place. So why are women around the world made to feel dirty, cursed, or unworthy because of their monthly periods? Many women resist these unflattering and socially irresponsible norms by pointing to patriarchy and reclaiming the narrative around menstruation and feminine health in the media.
With the book, I wanted to reclaim not only our ancestry and our traditions, but I wanted to reframe the conversation around menstruation.
That's Ida Salazar. She wrote the book, The Moon Within, a coming-of-age story that explores the themes of new love, gender identity, and first periods. The book offers readers a refreshing radical perspective of menstruation that is centered in a woman's power rather than shame.
We have lost the relationship that it's a powerful thing to menstruate. And patriarchy robbed us of that and gave us a narrative that said that our menstruations are dirty, to be feared, to be ignored or silenced and or ashamed of. And so I wanted this book to be not only a book that readers would really gravitate to because they're curious about their lives and their changing lives at the moment, but one where they would understand the deeper significance of what it means to reclaim that power. It really is an act of resistance to be able to speak about your period without shame, to know that you menstruate for 7 days and you don't die, and that in that same process is what brought every single human being into this world. Every person came from a menstruator, and yet it has been silenced for years and relegated to shame and secrecy.
Women from all walks of life are shunned and stigmatized while on their periods. Whether it's something subtle like feeling undesirable or something blatant like being barred from a place of worship or forced to sleep in a menstrual shed, this approach of pushing women away for simply experiencing a normal bodily process can have seriously harmful impacts on women's self-esteem. Nolwenn Cifuentes, a self-taught portrait photographer based in Los Angeles, California, believes that negative associations with periods can even undermine self-care and healthy engagement with one's body.
Period stigma and feeling ashamed about your period, it doesn't allow you to talk about your body in a healthy way. I mean, if you're ashamed of your body and something very natural and actually something very beautiful and powerful that your body does, and you feel bad about it and you don't want to talk about it, and you even like disconnect with your body, you know, you're like, this is like a thing that happens to me that's gross. You're not going to feel good about yourself.
Aside from the emotional changes that menstruation can bring on, periods can cause a range of physical challenges, but it can be difficult to talk about, and the silence is harming the long-term and physical health of women, Ida Salazar.
You know, there hasn't been any conversation around people who menstruate and how painful it is with like endometriosis or multiple cysts and whatnot. You know, there are all sorts of conditions that afflict menstruators that we can't even talk about. There's an incredible ignorance. Many women don't know what their vulvas look like. They've never seen them. They don't know what it is when they're pregnant or when their pregnancies are failing. I had a friend who had an ectopic pregnancy recently, and she did not know the process, a fallopian tube, you know, gathering the egg from the ovary and putting it into the uterus. She didn't know that process. That to me is so shocking. But these are reflective of how the stigma has snuffed our ability to explore and to understand our own bodies.
And it's this pathology of silence and social stigma intertwined with misogyny that has kept women virtually mute on the subject. But the shame and secrecy around menstruation is slowly diminishing as it's challenged by a new generation of period activists. Some women are using shocking means to bring attention to the normalcy of periods, like London Marathon runner Kiran Gandhi, who refused to wear a tampon and was seen smiling in her blood-stained biker shorts at the finish line in 2015. Or like photographer Cifuentes, who recently curated a photo series called Period Peace, depicting queer couples enjoying period sex to challenge the stigmas associated with menstruation.
So having this conversation with my friends and them being so freaked out and grossed out about it just inspired me to make a photo series showing that period sex doesn't have to be so horrifying, you know, and that it actually can be very uniting and bonding and intimate.
For the most part, the photo series was well received, with some criticism coming from individuals who felt period sex shouldn't be openly explored outside of the bedroom. But that didn't stop Nolwenn from bringing attention to what she sees as an issue of social control.
Yeah, I absolutely believe that, you know, people with periods not being able to be in control of their own narratives, that is a huge form of gender injustice. I think that the way to rethink this and to take back control of our bodies realize that this is a social stigma that we've been conditioned to think by people who don't get periods, that we've been conditioned to think because of extreme religion that sees women as, you know, objects to be owned by cis men. So the first thing is just becoming aware of that. And then once you're aware of that, you can start talking about it. So I think we just need to be like very vocal about it. We need to not, you know, secretly hide our tampons when we're like passing it to a friend or when we're buying it. Just be more open about it and be more proud about it.
This emerging movement has led to some pretty creative efforts by individuals who are choosing to address menstruation through literature, photography, and even social media. Ida Salazar.
There's an interesting hashtag on Instagram or anywhere you can find. It's just hashtag menstruation. And you'll see how incredible women and menstruators are taking back that fear and that loathing, that narrative that people have given us by demonstrating what it is to bleed and making fun of it and celebrating it in different kinds of rituals and actually showing blood. And there's certain artists who are creating artwork with their menstrual blood. Some are being very educated and very didactic about it. This is the way your body works. This is what the inside of a uterus that is bleeding looks like. There's a lot of movement, I think, that is happening across the country to combat that.
In her book, The Moon Within, Ida reclaims indigenous period rituals as a way to empower women and celebrate the beauty of womanhood. A departure from the Western perspective that periods are biological and nothing more.
My book included period, end of sentence, the documentary that won the Oscar recently, also as part of this kind of zeitgeist that is understanding that we're not going to let the narrative, the dominant narrative, that our menstruations are the curse or to be feared or loathed, to continue. We're going to stop it by reframing the narrative, by challenging it and celebrating it.
It's this kind of excitement that's both challenging patriarchy and providing space for women's conversation about their health and wellness. It's a new wave in an old ocean of women's deep knowledge. New rituals building upon some of the women-centered ancient rituals celebrating our periods as a natural process, aligned with the moon cycle. For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson. We are all used to paying sales tax on most of the things that we buy on a daily basis. Taxes, after all, are a significant source of state revenue, but there are certain items that don't get taxed, items designated as being basic necessities that are medical in nature, items such as aspirin and Viagra, for example. So why then are feminine hygiene products, basic necessities, still being taxed? Reporter Rosie McLeod looks into the so-called tampon tax and how it's impacting women around the world.
Over 20 million packs of tampons are sold every year in the UK alone. A woman uses an estimated 240 individual tampons per year. Sanitary towels and tampons cost the average British woman over £18,000 in a lifetime. That's more than $23,000. So what makes these very basic items so expensive? Well, they are taxed as luxuries at a rate of 5%. This policy is by no means unique to the UK. In the US, tampons and sanitary towels are treated as commercial products. They have a sales tax that varies between states. 10 European countries tax menstrual products at over 20%. This is now known as the tampon tax and was kept well hidden until it was called out in 2014 by Laura Corriton, a student living in London. Laura launched a petition on the website change.org. The purpose? To remove the tax on feminine hygiene products. The cause went viral and accumulated over 320,000 signatures, forcing many people to question the logic of a tampon tax to begin with. Laura Corriton.
I looked into our taxation system and realised that, like, even though tampons are taxed on a luxury basis, there are loads of other things that are taxed, or not taxed at all, because they're considered so essential, like maintaining our private helicopters or like eating horse meat or crocodile meat, which is two things we eat a lot in the UK.
Laura's petition made great strides by succeeding in the UK. However, the government won't consider ending the tampon tax until 2022. In the meantime, Laura has taken steps to ensure the government deliver on their promise.
We decided to start this thing called Period Watch, which will essentially just keep an eye on the government and make sure that they know that we are aware of the fact that they haven't done it. We asked lots of people to send in stories of their periods or just like fun facts or whatever, just so A, to keep an eye on the government so we can update people through that site, and B, just so we can continue to like break the period taboo.
The taxation of feminine hygiene products has been allowed to happen under the radar, largely because the topic of menstruation is still so taboo. It's rarely addressed in daily conversations, let alone public discussions. Opening up about periods has therefore been central to the American Sister campaigns, widely known as the Campaign for Menstrual Equity. Its co-founder is lawyer Jennifer Weisswolf. Here's Jennifer talking about her book Periods Gone Public, which has become a centerpiece for the campaign to end the tampon tax.
The book is actually intended really to be a platform for a policy agenda, but in doing so, of course, we wanted to explore the history of menstruation, particularly in the United States, how access is so impacted by the ability to afford menstrual products, why it is that they're expensive, why it is that we know so little about them, how, you know, religious and social and cultural stigma fits in. So all of that is part of the book. But what the book kind of culminates in is this policy agenda that focuses to ensure access to products through legislation, whether at the city, state, or federal level. I was watching this tampon tax campaign unfold here in the UK and in Canada and in other parts of the world. And I thought, well, we should be doing that here in the United States too, because at the time, this was late 2015, so 40 of the 50 states at that time did not exempt menstrual products from sales tax. So it was going to mean 40 different campaigns. But it struck me as just part of sort of the entire structural disadvantage that women face just in leading their lives. And we've seen tremendous progress in the United States on the tampon tax issue. 24 states in two legislative sessions in 2016 and 2017 introduced bills to exempt menstrual products from sales tax, and four actually got it done, which may not sound, you know, that still leaves us with 36 states to go, but four states passing laws on an issue never before talked about within 2 years is actually radically fast progress.
Increased awareness around the tampon tax has shown that not all women can afford basic sanitary items. This has given rise to a new buzzword, period poverty. This phenomenon is characterized by a lack of access to sanitary products, menstrual hygiene education, toilets, hand washing facilities, and/or waste management. The recent recognition of period poverty has produced a number of action groups working to provide menstrual products to those who cannot afford them. According to Girl Guiding, the British equivalent of Girl Scouts, 49% of girls in the UK have skipped school on their period because they could not afford feminine hygiene products. Tina Leslie believes that the lack of menstrual education, combined with the challenges of poverty, create serious hardships for girls and women all around the world. Hardships that are totally preventable. Tina founded Freedom for Girls to provide maxi pads to women in Kenya. Volunteers hold workshops and show women how to make the pads.
Basically, it was a colleague of mine who said to me, she rang me up and said, I've got some girls, you know, in the school and they're not coming to school because their parents can't afford sanitary protection. But also as well, one of them actually said that she didn't even realise what a period was. She was having a period for 2 years and she just kept quiet. On the back of the, you know, the Kenya thing, it was the same as, right, well, what we're going to do about it? Let's start something up. Let's start providing schools, colleges, refugee agencies, refugees, anywhere that needs products, we will try and supply them. So washable reusables that we make, they last around about 3 years. The menstrual cups are around 10 years. I think the poverty issue is a really big issue, especially in the UK. I mean, it's all over the world. You know, why do we know 60% of girls and women in Kenya don't have access to safe, you know, period protection? but we don't know what it is in the UK. Because, you know, all the research that's been done has been on very small cohorts of girls. So between 14 and 25-year-olds. What about all the women? All the women that are suffering period poverty.
Many influential women have taken the first steps to destigmatizing menstruation by unapologetically bringing the topic to decision makers. As recently as October 2019, the founders of women's reproductive brand Lola, along with the Campaign for Menstrual Equity, have named the sales tax unconstitutional. Since 2014, menstrual products have been weaponized in debates across the wider political landscape. Tampons have become central to a war between progressives and conservative legislators. In 2017, it was announced that some of the UK tampon tax money was funding an anti-abortion charity. Some opposed scrapping the tax because that money could be spent on government-sponsored women's causes. Women's causes that, interestingly, were not such pressing issues before this whole debate unfolded. Despite the efforts of activists in the UK and in the US, female hygiene products are still considered luxuries, and the unfair tampon tax continues to create barriers for women worldwide. For Making Contact, I'm Rosie McLeod, reporting from London.
You're listening to Don't Let Them See You Bleed, Period, on Making Contact. If you like what you're hearing today, you may want to check out a podcast called The V Word. Making Contact shows are distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S. To find out how to support us, download shows, or get our podcast, go to radioproject.org, like us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Now back to Don't Let Them See You Bleed, Period, on Making Contact. It's estimated that 85% of menstruators in the U.S. use up to 16,000 tampons during their lifetime. Feminine care ads often promote tampons as a way to be secure while on your period. But how safe are these products?
And there's really so much that we don't know about how these products are affecting our health.
That's Alexander Scranton, the Director of Science and Research at Women's Voices for the Earth, a national organization working to eliminate toxic chemicals that impact women's health.
There's a fair amount of data on toxic shock syndrome, which is linked to a bacteria that can grow, particularly in tampons, and lead to some very serious effects. What we don't know is no one's really looked at how many other kinds of reactions, adverse reactions like rashes or infections that are associated with the use of either tampons or pads due to the chemical exposures that come from these. We certainly have no idea whether women who use tampons are getting more cases of cancer than women who don't use tampons. No one's even looked at asking these sorts of questions.
The business of feminine hygiene care is a $3 billion industry that isn't required by the Food and Drug Administration to list product ingredients and chemicals used in the processing of these ingredients.
The Food and Drug Administration regulates menstrual products like tampons and pads and menstrual cups as medical devices, I guess because they are absorbing, internal fluids, et cetera. And because they are medical devices, there is no law on the books that says that medical devices need to disclose their ingredients. And so for largely, companies have not been disclosing that information.
It's this labeling of tampons as medical devices that has presented the greatest barrier in consumers' right to know. Consider the fact that there are two main types of period products, external and internal. External products include maxi pads, while internal products or tampons go directly into the vagina to absorb blood flow before it exits the body. A woman's vaginal wall is so permeable, any toxin and chemical in a tampon can be absorbed into the bloodstream.
We have found some very questionable chemicals in these products, some that have been associated with cancer and reproductive harm. We find them at very low levels, but we don't know what that impact has on these products that we use, several days a month for nearly a lifetime.
As women, we have become so accustomed to seeking out products that will most likely avert a period disaster that we have not fully explored the health impacts of these feminine hygiene products. Alexandra Scranton from Women's Voices for the Earth launched the Detox the Box campaign, created to raise awareness about the chemicals and their potential harmful impacts on our health.
when we started the Detox the Box campaign, we only found two studies that were kind of in the available literature that looked at tampons. It was looking at chemicals called dioxins and furans, which are very, very highly toxic chemicals linked to cancer and linked to a number of other health problems. So there were two studies that were done. Both studies concluded that this wasn't a problem, even though they did find certain levels of these products in tampons. And then we couldn't find anything else. So we, in 2014, took some Always pads, the leading brand in the U.S., took them to a lab and had them analyzed for volatile organic compounds, which are chemicals that can be very toxic that can gas off a substance. So these were chemicals that were actually gassing off of the pad. We found things like styrene, benzene, toluene. These are not very friendly chemicals. They're certainly more associated with kind of industrial exposures. And we did find them at very small levels. Since then, we've been kind of tracking the data. There have been about 15 other studies that have happened around the world. A lot of other countries have tested pads and tampons for volatile organic compounds. There's been a great increase in interest in testing for pesticides. We don't know what these exposures mean yet. Again, usually it's very low levels of these chemicals, which the companies tell us are not a problem. But we think we need more research to really understand what these exposures mean and where they're coming from in the process of making these products.
When we see ads for tampons and pads, we definitely don't hear about what it takes to make these products, like bleaching of fiber or what Tampax lists on its website as the purification of cotton and rayon. And although tampon manufacturers started to adopt less harmful processes in the late 1990s, traces of the highly toxic chemical compound dioxin can still be found in rayon raw material range at undetectable 0.1 to 1 parts per trillion. While the FDA currently requires tampon manufacturers to monitor dioxin levels in their finished products, the results are not available to the public.
For a long time, these manufacturers have said, we have our experts, we assure these products are safe, and people have trusted that, okay, they say their products are safe, they must be safe, and surely the government must be on top of it. Unfortunately, our laws are simply not that strong. The manufacturers are not required to explain very carefully how they're ensuring that their ingredients are safe in their products, or even how they are researching these products to assure that they're safe. We've tried to get some of that information through, you know, Freedom of Information Act requests, et cetera. It's very, very difficult to get. They're very hesitant to share what that information is that they know about their products and how they're ensuring that they're safe. But I really think these days the sort of stance of, you know, trust us, we're the experts, is no longer satisfying for many consumers.
One would think that anything that we put into our bodies should come with a list of ingredients and, if necessary, a health warning, kind of like cigarettes. But as we know, using the tobacco industry as an example, seemingly simple disclosure about ingredients and the possible health risks do not come without a fight. When it comes to women's health, there are some advocates within the government who are demanding transparency from companies that produce feminine hygiene products.
We have a bill in New York State that would require manufacturers to disclose the ingredients in menstrual products. There's a federal bill that Congresswoman Grace Meng has introduced called the Menstrual Right to Know Act. So that's getting it also into the kind of the public sphere because it's going into Congress. There's the Robin Danielson Feminine Hygiene Product Safety Act. This is a bill that's been introduced about 9 times by Congressman Maloney of New York, also requiring more research into the health impacts of period and intimate care products on women's health.
Seventh Generation, an eco-friendly company, is one of the champions of the Menstrual Products Right to Know Act. On their website, Seventh Generation states that consumers need to worry about what the heck is in the products you use around the vagina, calling for tampons, pads, and vaginal dish packaging to include a list of ingredients on the label, especially given the cancer risk linked to dioxins.
It's amazing how little research there is. I mean, one interesting fact that nobody ever hears about, we read one study that says that the incidence of vulvar cancer, which is a very rare cancer of the vulva, has increased 411% in the last 30 years. I mean, it's just this mind-boggling increase in the last 30 years. It's, you know, a very, very small number of women, and now it's a larger, very, very small number of women who get this cancer. But, you know, this is not something that can be explained genetically. There is something happening that is causing this massive increase that really needs to be looked at. So, you know, there can be lots of factors that contribute, but the products that you use every day should not be one of those factors. That should be something that we can rely on to be safe.
More than 90% of human exposure to dioxins comes through our food supply, mainly meat, fish, shellfish, and dairy products. So does this mean that we should not study the presence of dioxins in feminine hygiene products? The message that women get is, tampons are safe, dioxin traces are very low, there's nothing to worry about. But this is where research scientists like Alexandra say it's time to prioritize women's health. Through research of feminine hygiene products, through product transparency, and through strict safety regulations, even on so-called organic pads and tampons.
Overall, our laws on chemicals and products are just unfortunately weak. It's really hard with the laws we have in place right now to regulate chemicals in the products that we use every day, whether they be cosmetics or menstrual products. People don't want to talk about vaginas. They don't want to talk about these products. They let things go. So they don't get the same attention. Certainly, it has not been a priority for the Food and Drug Administration. We have tried, you know, petitioning them. We did a petition a number of years ago on feminine washes, which had some very dangerous, or we believe, very dangerous colorants in them. And we asked them to produce some guidance for companies as to which colorants were going to be appropriate for this use. And they just straight out said, you know, we've got competing priorities and this is not an appropriate use of our resources. This is not something we want to pay attention to. So yes, I think there is definitely a level of sexism. This is a women's problem. It's not something that's going to get a priority either from Congress or from our government agencies.
For Making Contact, I'm Anita Johnson. You've been listening to Don't Let Them See You Bleed, period, on Making Contact. If you like what you heard today, check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Anita Johnson. Thanks for listening.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is now 9:31. Up next is WINGS, Women's International News Gathering Service, a program by and about women around the world.
Today on WINGS, changing the minds and behavior of India's dear boys.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to WINGS, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
In 2017, police in Kolkata, India, started a program called Dear Boys to influence boys in 9th through 12th grades to treat girls and women with more respect and fairness. Kalpana Pradhan, our WINGS reporter in Kolkata, collected sound and interviews. She started with the founder of the project, Swati Sengupta.
So, Swati, could you please tell me in the beginning how it came in your mind?
Actually, it has always been a part of the discussion in college among friends and with teachers. The violence is coming from the men. So if you do not address men, then how can this problem be, how can you overcome this problem? So it is something that needs to be discussed with men. And we always believe that, you know, the younger the better, because it's easier to influence and mold a person at a younger age, and they should understand this right from a young age. You know, younger children react more positively, they are more accepting. When I was doing the sessions with the children, it was not specifically addressed for only boys. It was for girls and boys and young children. And the reason I prepared this project and approached the Kolkata police, because I think it is important that especially a law enforcing agency supports it, it becomes more acceptable, people accepted. So I'm glad that Kolkata police authorities, they liked the idea and they have accepted it, and therefore we could do this project.
India has experienced rapid social transformation and economic growth, but gender bias in India continue to limit women opportunities, and widespread preference for sons leads to selective abortion of female fetuses and discrimination in education, nutrition, and healthcare. In the past decade, while Indian GDP has grown up by around 6%, there has been a large decline in female labor force participation from 34% to 27%. And violence against women is manifesting itself in newer forms, and the oppression of socially excluded women is taking on brutal contours. So gender activists point out the importance to educate Indian children about gender equality from an early age. There has been a meaningful start in that direction. Aiming to make a safer city for girls and women, the Kolkata police in the state capital of West Bengal and a writer and gender activist took initiative to educate teenage school boys to respect women and girls. This special session was underway in a boys' school of South Kolkata, where students all in their teens were listening to Swati Sengupta, a gender activist and a writer. She said to Wings that gender equality sessions is a kind of information to the boys that how they behave with girls, which were rarely discussed at home or their classrooms, nor in their syllabus.
Actually, I have been doing sessions with children for several years now. And this Dear Boys project was a project of, 20 sessions with school children of Kolkata, which I tied up with the Kolkata police authorities. And this is basically a session where I address primarily teenage boys. These sessions are general discussions that I'm teaching at the sessions. Is basically, telling boys how they should be sensitive and responsible young men when they grow up. And these are not, sessions that where I tell them that this is what you should do and this is what you have to do. But basically, these are discussions on equality of men and women. I show them presentations and I tell them why women and men are equal. I show them certain things like clippings from films and advertisements and how to overcome this gap that exists.
I have seen that you show Bollywood film clips, but what your message?
In these popular films and advertisements, I show them the way that this gender gap, this disparity is always apparent. And the moment you discuss it with the teenage boys, they understand, And these things are normally never discussed at home or even with teachers. These things are not discussed separately. So I think these classes are generally very helpful because these are things that they really find interesting and they notice that they see all around them where men and women are not treated as equals, but they are never told how these things, these ads, commercials and these films disrespect the way women are projected. So this is something that gets into their mind but doesn't happen very in a conscious way. These things are not pointed out to them. So when these things are pointed out and discussed, that is when they understand. But the focus is not on rape figures or the molestation figures. They are not bombarded with all that which they read about in newspapers and watch on news. It's a general thing, something that is suitable for their age
and something that gets into them without their knowing it. It's so much ingrained in our culture. They see this this violence on women happening all around them. So they understand, they know, but they do not know why and how it is happening. I think it's important to tell them at this age and in a right way. So that is what I try.
And how do they react actually? What kind of things in their mind after discussed with you?
There is a lot of difference between boys this age and when they are almost adults, when they are like in class 9, 10, mostly when they are in 10, 11, when they are just about to be adults. By then, they have already, you know, formed their opinions. So the reactions are different when it comes to younger boys and slightly older boys. The older boys generally try to say that men also face sexual harassment. They try to present an alternative case. But then I have to show them, I have to tell them that, you know, the figure, this is what the figures show. Actually, majority are boys, but I also tell the schools where these are co-ed schools, I also tell the school authorities that there must be, you know, some girls present, because then, you know, the problems, the difficulties that the girls their age face, they can, you know, present their point of view and, you know, the violence, the problems that the women face. And I also tell them about the LGBTQ. These issues are also brought in. So it's basically the fact that you have to treat individuals as individuals, not as, you know, men or women. And equality of all the sexes, you know, I point out. In one of these the schools, it was a boys' school, you know, a lot of boys were saying that if women want to be equal, then why do they ask for reserved seats in buses?
Actually, they don't like it.
They don't like it. And sometimes the older boys say that, you know, in buses there are reservations. Then why should women accept this? So then one of the boys in the class, he stood up and said that, you know, you will not understand this because in public transport you have not faced harassment. It's so difficult for women. So as long as this does not go, unless molestation stops, because this continues to happen, it has not stopped, then you have to give them that space. That's why the need for reserved seats in public transport. You know, one of them have understood this because he has a sister. So I think a lot of argument comes because the insensitive attitude. Their classmates, when they have periods, boys must understand and be sensitive. They must also, you know, offer seats. So it is, I think, important for the boys to understand. Sensitivity has all these different layers. It's not just about rights, it's also about sensitive and responsible.
तुझे कोई भी बात बता जाए तेरे पेचे में कुत्ते क्या आए
आप पहले खाना खा लीजिए बेटा और दाल
लगो
दाल
लगो मत लड़ाई
Shruti was showing popular Bollywood Hindi film clips in the session where male members were having dinner and female members of the family were serving food. The females can have their food only after finish the male members eating. She strongly pointed out such treatment towards women, which most of the Indian families still follow, are not the right way to show respect to women. People should change such old patriarchal practice, and it should start from home, said author and gender activist Shruti Sengupta.
You know, something like in a lot of families, the men eat first and then, you know, the women serve the men, and once the men have eaten, then women sit down to eat. You know, I tell them that it is not that practice in every family, and they understand what I mean. Children need to be addressed, the boys need to be addressed, and it must start from a very young age in order to make a change. So it is something that I always believed in, and I always wanted to do this, to talk to boys about it. So that I have always felt was necessary, since nobody was doing it.
On Wings, this is a program by Kalpana Pradhan from Kolkata, India, about re-educating boys to accept gender equality. Her main interviewee is Swati Sengupta, who both teaches and writes on the subject. One of Sengupta's books is titled Half the Field is Mine. It's about a mixed-sex soccer team, or football as most of the world calls it.
One of my books is about a mixed football team where boys and girls play in the same football team. This is a book for teenagers, and I always enjoy talking to children. And so I was doing these book reading sessions in different schools all over the country. And when I was discussing this book with children in different schools in Delhi, in Lucknow, in Mumbai, in different schools in Kolkata and Bhubaneswar, elsewhere, many cities, these sessions were also about discussing with teenagers the concept of equality. How, you know, girls are not allowed by their parents, and what neighbors think when they wear shorts and start playing football with boys. It is not allowed. I have seen that so many girls enjoy playing football, or they want to play football, but they have never been told to play football. So everywhere this thing exists, that women are not allowed to do whatever they feel they want to do. They cannot go out after a certain time. The girl will be asked to return home, but her brother will not be asked to return home at the same time. It doesn't go with the concept of freedom. The freedom exists for a boy, it doesn't exist for a girl. So why should that happen? So it's something which I know that these things are there in their minds, and they want to discuss this. These are things that needs to be discussed more with them.
Till now, how many schools accepted such gender equality sessions?
Dear Boys project covered 20 schools, but I have done a number of schools before that, and after that I have been continuing to do these sessions in schools. Some of the schools, you know, they continue to ask me to do sessions in their schools, and I've done in children's homes and elsewhere also. You know, at my place, I continue to do this. Without funding, it's difficult to move out and do it in villages. But I've done these sessions in all kinds of schools, in private schools, I've done it in government schools, I've done it in English, Bengali and Hindi medium schools. Even for children who come from not so privileged backgrounds, I've done sessions with them also. I would like to go to villages and do it in all kinds of schools, even in village schools, but unfortunately at this moment I have not been able to do it because there are no funds.
So for last 2 years, you were continuing this kind of session in the schools. So do you think it's really changed their mindset?
The change is definitely there, that I can tell you. But it has to be done in large scale, you know, methodically, in a planned way, and constantly. I usually talk to them before the session, and I talk to them after the session separately. They understand, even if not many are articulate. So I ask them before the sessions, and I ask them the same set of questions after the session, and there's clear change. So, but I think, you know, these sessions with the same children, same set of children, it needs to be done again and again for them to, you know, fully understand. Because doing one session and then going back to the same environment, going back to the, you know, same public transport, the same set of people, the same family where equality is not practiced at home, it is difficult for one session to completely change a person. And I do not expect that either. But for some children, I have done a number of sessions, and therefore in those sessions, among those children, I have seen some distinct changes. So for that, I think it needs to be done more frequently for a certain period of time. When I ask them before the sessions, there is any difference between men and women, in girls and boys, and they say that yes. And I ask them that, you know, should girls wear a certain kind of clothes? And do you think they are teased because they wear certain kinds of clothes? before the sessions, they always say yes. Because some girls wear short clothes, their skirts or clothes are so-called, you know, within quotes, not good. They do not project themselves as good women, good girls, you know, that's why they get teased. After the session, I show them a picture of Priyanka Chopra and her mother wearing, you know, very short skirts. And I show them another photo of a man wearing a shorter length of shorts that he's wearing. Tell them that nobody would react to the man wearing, you know, the length of the man's shorts, but it comes to the women's clothes. So why is there this difference? And by then, I've already told them, right from birth, they are treated differently. They are given different kinds of toys to play with. They are made to wear different kinds of clothes. So by then they know that there is no difference between girls and boys and men and women. And then I'm showing them the picture. Gradually they start to understand by then that there is no difference between men and women, which is why directly I do not talk about molestation. I do not talk directly about violence, because that's not something that children would like to, you know, sort of, it's a kind of a negative way of approaching. So I try to do it more positively, and I talk more about equality. I do not talk about the gender, you know, violence. I casually tell them that this is the reason why violence is taking place, and something that needs to, you know, there should be a positive change in the minds of people who are being violent on women. By then, they have understood they should not react negatively to a woman who is wearing short clothes, because that is her choice and it's a matter of choice for a person, and that should be respected. And this is something that nobody has the right to react in a certain way. It's a question of a person's independence. By the end of the session, I asked the same questions that I've asked them before the session started. You know, just the opposite, that yes, we used to think, but after the session, we do think choice of clothes does not make a person good or bad. It is something that we should not react to. I think these sessions, once you go on telling a person this, I think they do understand at some point, and it needs to be constantly done. Therefore, the need to repeat these sessions with children.
Exactly. And you discussed about Me Too campaign also.
Yeah. Such classes. It's something that I did not bring up. It's something that the children themselves brought up. Because at that point, these things, these narratives were coming in, and they have read it in the papers. The number of women, it has touched, I mean, no woman is spared. The sheer number is horrifying, and they understand that also, because they're teenagers, they know everything.
After 2-3 sessions in a same school, boys have changed their attitudes towards girls. Babu Shona, a 15-year-old boy, students of 10th standard of a Bengali medium school in South Kolkata, now giving gender equality knowledge to the other students at the NGO-run home, where he is staying nearby his school. His mother is a domestic helper, living in a slum in the city. He saw poverty from his childhood. After the sessions, Babu Shona has changed his mind towards girls.
মানে বাড়িতে যখন মা বলে যে মেয়েদের সাথে মিশবি না, মেয়েদের থেকে দূরে থাকবি, তখন আমি বলি যে কেন মিশবো না, ওরাও তো আমাদের মতো নেই.
Babu Shona said his mother always said to him not to play with girls in his neighborhood because football is not a game for girls, and girls who are playing with boys is not good. Babu loved football. He said earlier he didn't react on it, but after the sessions, he wants explanations from his mother about so-called not good meaning. But his mother failed to say so. He told his mother that there is no fault to play football with girls, and girls have same rights to play football. Now he encouraged to his sister to play football with boys.
ছেলেরা যেটা করতে পারবে মেয়েদের সেটার অধিকার আছে, তো ওদের অধিকার নিয়ে নেওয়ার আমাদের কোনো অধিকার নেই, আমি আগে এটা জানতাম না, আন্টি বলার পর আমি এটা জানতে পেরেছি।
Crime against women is a topic that has been debated multiple times, but the correct way to address the issue has also been a topic of deliberation. There is no question that till date, gender bias is a problem in India. The list of traditions that put women at a disadvantaged stage literally begins at birth and carries on through childhood to marriage and then adulthood. Gender studies is very important to teach students, but sex education is also necessary for teenage boys and girls to stop crime against women, said social scientist and professor Dr. Bula Bhadra.
We have been fighting for a long time in India whether to introduce sex education in schools. If you do not discuss sex, you do not discuss the orientation of sexuality, if you don't discuss the rights, how do you expect boys not to think women as commodities and then, you know, try to coerce them? And India has highest number of rapes, sexual harassments, this and that. So how do you expect this to go by law? Of course not. You have to bring it right from the beginning, right from the childhood, thinking your next person, whatever the sex is actually a person equal to you. So there is no question of forcing or coercing or being violent. India has one of the highest domestic violence on women. And we have been, see, women have been accepting it for a long time, lot of women. So naturally it is not going away. It has become a sort of an unwritten position that laws are there, but still, nothing is going away. We have laws, we have post-Nirbhaya laws, we have now capital punishment if the victim dies. So this kind of situation will never going to go away. Now we have a new game started. We corner transgender people because now they have come out, they're recognized, they're coming out in number, they're going to different places, they don't have the occupation we used to know. If the rights remain on paper, what good is it? There's no good about it. So we have to be much more conscious and aware. And that consciousness can only come if we penetrate right from class one, right from the time the child is exposed to the outer world, to the other persons, to the realities, etc. And you know, one thing is very interesting. We have not understood one very core matter in the school curriculum. At some point we used to have that called value education. We need to inculcate values.
Entire education system is wrong?
Problematic. And that becomes more violent in case of women. Because the more difficulty you have in the total system, it will translate more on the marginalized sections. Women, those who have made it, not them, but the women, those who haven't made it, or let's say working class children, transgender people, slum areas, etc. All these things, this will matter. See, if we don't have women teachers in good numbers in the schools, some of the parents won't send their girls because there is this fear that male teachers might abuse, which happens in India. I guess everywhere it happens, but it happens quite a bit in India. So number of good quality trained teachers, women teachers, are very much needed. So it's a question of changing the mindset of all of us. That can only start if we have gender neutral education. Gender neutral education must be like, irrespective of the economic condition, everybody should have the right to education. Not everybody is receiving education. So the first thing is imparting education to each one of the children of India, which is still much lagging behind. And I think all schools after, let's say, 3 or 4 should be co-ed, because keeping separate schools, etc., means actually gendering people in a very, very subtle way. You need to break the barrier structurally that there is no need for different schools.
Social scientist and professor Dr. Bula Bhadra. According to UNICEF, poverty and cultural beliefs cause discrimination against girl children, which are some of the major factors behind gender inequality in education throughout India. There is still a struggle to give girls the same level of education as their male members get. So experts are saying that gender study, especially for boys, would break the existing hurdles to change the Indian society in coming days. Kalpana Pradhan, Wings, Kolkata, India.
To hear this and other Wings programs again, visit our website wingsradio.org or email wings@wings.org. Please also check facebook.com/wingsradio to see information we share from around the world. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, editor of the new book, The Maternal Basis of the Gift Economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. I'm Wings series producer Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is now 10 a.m. Up next is Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and clarification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be conducted at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, unless otherwise noted.
This month, the Personnel Governance Committee is meeting on Friday, November 15th at 5 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Privacy versus the Rise of Surveillance Tech on Monday, November 18th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Northwest Academy in Portland. Cyrus Farivar, author of the book Hobbyist Data, will speak on legal and privacy history and what our rights are currently.